In midday and midnight marriages, hundreds of same-sex couples in Florida say, I do. Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, where we discuss the week that was and dig behind the news and newsmakers making those headlines. Same-sex marriage becomes the law of the land in Florida, but Attorney General Pam Bondi has not given up the court challenges, and the nation's highest court meets in private to consider a set of same-sex marriage cases nationwide. Governor Scott takes his second oath of office as his second term as governor begins. His goal? Make Florida the global leader in job creation. He promises $1 billion in tax cuts and billions of spending on roads. It's been 5 years since the devastating earthquake in Haiti, and the political crisis faces a deadline next week. It's all ahead on the Florida Roundup next on WLRN. Here we are on a Florida Roundup. Another week is gone in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson on WLRN. Thanks for listening. The new year began with the sound of wedding bells throughout South Florida, wedding bells that had been silenced by a court order that expired this week. Miami-Dade became the first county in Florida to issue marriage licenses for same-sex couples hours before a federal court stay was lifted at midnight for the rest of the state. Wedding ceremonies began midday on Monday in Miami and were held just after midnight, early morning Tuesday, in the Keys, Broward, and Palm Beach counties. Miami Beach residents Juan Talavera and Jeff Ronci were some of the first in line to get a license.
I'm thrilled.
You guys beat the rush over here.
I'm grateful to soon be able to call Juan my husband. Yeah. And I think in time, society will recognize that this is good for everyone.
More than 1,400 same-sex marriage licenses have been issued in Florida since Monday. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court may decide, perhaps even as soon as today, if the constitutional right to marry for the LGBT community applies nationwide or if it's up to the individual states to decide. Now, Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi has led the charge to defend Florida's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. Despite losing in local and federal courts, she has not given up her appeal to stop same-sex marriages.
We hope they take it. That's what we've wanted all along because we want uniformity. So think about it. It's not fair if someone can get married in Miami but not in another county.
But this is a different argument than what Bondi was making just a week ago. She had been arguing in the federal case in Washington County, Florida, in which Judge Robert Hinkle ruled eventually the state ban was against the U.S. Constitution. Pam Bondi arguing that ruling applied only to that singular county in the panhandle. So he clarified his ruling. On New Year's Day, the stay expired. Same-sex marriage is now lawful in the state of Florida, a little more than 6 years after voters approved a state amendment outlawing it. So how do you feel? Do you agree? Should same-sex couples have the same right to marry as opposite-sex couples in Florida? Did a federal judge just reject the will of the majority of voters 6 years ago in Florida? Let us know here on the Florida Roundup this week at 1-800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Send us a tweet at WLRN or go online at WLRN.org. Steve Rothhaus of the Miami Herald is along with us here in Miami. Greg Allen, national correspondent for NPR in South Florida, also along with us. And from Tallahassee via Skype, Mary Ellen Kloss is with the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times. Happy New Year to all three of you, and welcome to the Florida Roundup. Steve, how was Miami-Dade, first of all, able to essentially provide licenses about 12 hours before the federal stay expired?
Well, because in Miami-Dade County, there was a separate case, a separate lawsuit filed back in January of 2014. There were six same-sex couples in Equality Florida Institute. They sued the county clerk, Harvey Reuven, demanding marriage licenses. They wanted the right to marry. So that case went to court last July, and in July of 2014, Miami-Dade Circuit Judge Sarah Zabel, she found the Florida's constitutional ban against gay marriage to be unconstitutional, and she ordered that the couples had the right to marry. But because of the nature of the case, because they were challenging the constitutionality of a Florida law, it was immediately stayed, the decision. Mm-hmm. And that would give the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, time to appeal the case.
Tell us, what was it like in the courtroom that day on Monday with Judge Zabel?
You know, it was incredibly fast. I mean,
it
I think
it was a very short hearing.
It was a very short hearing. Absolutely. 11 o'clock, Harvey Reuven had asked for a hearing Monday morning in which, you know, he was going to ask Sarah Zabel to expedite the case. Over the weekend, last weekend, Equality Florida, they made a motion to the judge to lift her stay. And that's exactly what she did. She convened in the courtroom at 11 o'clock and heard just a few minutes worth of testimony from the attorneys. And Pam Bondi's office was represented by the Solicitor General, Alan Windsor, on the phone from Tallahassee. Mm-hmm. And
at one point, Judge Zabel asked, does it matter if I do this or not, given the federal stay?
Exactly. And they said no. They said it makes no difference to us. And she said, okay, it makes no difference to you. And they said, right. She said, okay, I lift the stay. Bang.
Those
everyone
four
cheered.
Words.
I hit the button and sent out a tweet. You know, marriage is now legal. Get married. So that's how quickly it happened.
Yeah, those four words. And Greg Allen with NPR, not only did it happen quick this week, this whole process has been very quick for the state of Florida. I mean, the first local judge in Monroe County called the state constitutional ban on same-sex marriage unconstitutional just in the middle of 2014.
Right. This whole process took just a little over a year, or depending when you start counting. And the hearing on Monday, there was really a sense that everybody knew what Judge Zabel was going to say. I mean, we really didn't. But you had people waiting at the county clerk's office while that court hearing was going on, right, waiting in line to get their marriage licenses, you know, gay couples.
And we had some county clerks handing out essentially deli numbers like you get at the meat counter, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and county, you know, a couple number 34, time for your license, those kinds of things.
I think the interesting thing now is this, looking ahead to this case, I mean, could you imagine a judge now ruling, appeals court ruling that gay marriage would not be allowed, same-sex marriage wouldn't be allowed, and you would then roll the clock back here? It's kind of inconceivable to me. You know, a court certainly has the authority to do that, but once the genie's out of the bottle here, I don't know how you put it back in.
Well, there's a number of court cases still winding their way through, especially on the federal appeals court system. Mary Ellen Kloss with the Miami Herald in Tallahassee. Give us that North Florida lens, though, for same-sex marriage this week. Of course, you know, same-sex marriage was essentially legalized, became legal in the state of Florida the same day that Governor Scott was sworn in for his second term in office, and his attorney general has been leading the charge against allowing same-sex marriages.
And it was a fascinating juxtaposition this week, because this is something that the Republican establishment, for the most part, which won re-election this year, didn't really want to put much attention to. So Tuesday, as people were, you know, getting married across the state, Monday night when the marriage, you know, as marriages were happening in Miami-Dade, the governor and the attorney general really didn't want to talk about it very much. It was very interesting. The governor was inaugurated. It was a beautiful day here, and there wasn't a word about this huge landmark decision. And the governor actually made mention of the fact that a lot of people were moving to Florida because Florida is such a great place to be, and how Florida has more visitors than any other place. And the irony was that the greatest number of visitors we probably had on Tuesday were people that were flooding into the state from Alabama.
Yeah.
Who are trying to get married.
It's the southernmost state now allowing gay marriage, Steve Rothaus.
That's correct. And it's, you know, very interesting that, you know, obviously the marriage story far overshadowed the investiture of both Bondi and Scott. I mean, the number one story that day on the Miami Herald website was not the swearing in, but, you know, gay deputy in uniform, right, you know, gets married to his partner.
So that clearly was the case in South Florida. But Mary Ellen, what about the Panhandle counties? What about, you know, in Jacksonville and Duval County? What have you been able to ascertain of the support or lack thereof of gay marriage now being settled by a singular judge, a U.S. district judge?
Right. Well, what happened is there were a lot of counties that decided that they were no longer going to do the convenient marriages at the county clerk's office because of this ruling. So I would say that most of the North Florida counties that surround Leon County made that decision. And so the newly elected mayor of Tallahassee made an announcement and basically invited any same-sex couples that wanted to get married come to Tallahassee, and then he has invited them for a mass wedding ceremony that will be occurring in Tallahassee on Saturday. And then they also had the clerk's office opened in Leon County just about 2 hours before the governor was inaugurated, mm-hmm. and they allowed a lot of people to get married. And I'm not sure how many were from other counties, but the presumption was that people came from all over.
Well, you know, I think that we should be really clear about the fact that, yes, it was a U.S. district judge that issued this ruling, Judge Hinkle, in Tallahassee. But actually, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court did weigh in on this issue when Hinkle's stay was set to expire, and Bondi went first to a three-panel judge at the 11th Circuit in Atlanta and asked that panel to please extend the stay, and they said no. She then went to Clarence Thomas and said, please extend the stay. He passed it on to the full U.S. Supreme Court. They voted 7-2, no. So by voting no, both of those panels, they essentially said, yes, it is okay if thousands of gay people get married in the state of Florida.
Yeah. In the meantime, Greg Allen, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati is kind of the outlier with these court of appeals. It has said there's no constitutional right to marry, that it's a state's decision, it's not a federal government's decision. Four other appeals court have said exactly the opposite. And Judge Thomas and the kind of the thumbs up, thumbs down that they did with the Florida stay.
Right, the Clarence Thomas, yeah.
Yeah, notwithstanding, there still remains a question whether or not the Supreme Court's going to take this up.
Right, and even before we get to that, the question is what's going to happen with the Florida law. And I guess you could give the governor and the attorney general the benefit of the doubt and say that they're trying to just, not make comment until it's final. You could say that, and mm-hmm. that maybe that's the prudent thing to do. But you compare, like, say, Governor Scott's response, which is basically no response to this, to this action, to Jeb Bush, who has long opposed same-sex marriages, and he kind of begrudgingly said, "Wait, the law's the law, and
right.
and let's go with it."
Yeah,
you know?
And Governor Scott during the campaign has said, "I support equal rights." I mean, he never said, "I support gay marriage." I never support same-sex marriage. Didn't go that far. Similar to what former Governor Bush has talked about.
Right, but I think this is where you look for leadership. You look for politicians should be leaders. They should be actually willing to stand for something and go out for something. And that's where I think we're looking for someone like Governor Scott and the Attorney General to say what they think.
Well, we have seen that said by a political leader. Senator Rubio has said pretty unequivocally here, Steve Rothaus, that he's against same-sex marriage and does see this as a state's rights issue, not a federal government decision to make.
Correct, but he's not the person who's going to make the decision whether or not to keep this case alive. And, just this week, the Attorney General, she said, well, first she says to the clerks, you do as you please. She doesn't give any direction. And then in the end, all 67 counties, all 67 clerks agreed that they had no choice but to marry people. And then after that, when the law finally does happen and people ask her, are you planning to continue the appeal? Her response was, well, let's leave that up to the Solicitor General. She is not taking responsibility. Hmm. And it's very easy, I guess, at this point to say let it lie, because I don't see either the Third District Court of Appeal in Florida hearing this case in Miami-Dade County or the Keys, or the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals hearing the federal case at this point, because just today, the U.S. Supreme Court will decide whether or not it's going to take one of these other cases, probably Michigan, and then decide the issue nationally in June.
So this is the legal route here. That's Steve Rothaus with the Miami Herald. Greg Allen with NPR is along with us as well. Mary Ellen Kloss joining us via Skype from Tallahassee with Miami Herald Tampa Bay Times. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. You can join the conversation. Same-sex marriage becomes the law of the land in the Sunshine State this week. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN or on Twitter @WLRN. Is our handle there. Kim tweeting, it doesn't matter if the court went against the majority. If majority believes something is I'll use the word wrong instead of the word Kim uses in her tweet. If something is wrong, it doesn't make it not wrong. Jude tweeting us, perhaps, but the opinion of certain residents should not become a law that then infringes on the rights of others without the same opinion. You can join that conversation on Twitter at WLRN. The religious community also reacting to same-sex marriage here in Florida. Leaders from the Protestant, Jewish, and Episcopalian faiths embracing the news. The Archbishop of Miami, Thomas Wensky, warned church employees, though, not to express support for gay marriage, including on social media.
The fact that marriage has been understood for millennia as between a man and a woman for the purpose of raising a family, I don't think that has in any sense been discriminatory to other other people.
The leader of the Catholic faith here in Miami, Thomas Wensky, speaking to WLRN's Nadege Green this week. There was a memo, Steve Rothaus, that the Archbishop sent out that quoted from the Catholic Church's handbook about employee behavior and essentially denied them the ability to express any support in a professional capacity.
That's right. I mean, the memo said if you voice support for marriage, if you, you know, voice this either on social media or to anyone else in public, that you risk being terminated from your job at the church. And, you know, it's a very controversial, you know, situation. Should the church be allowed to keep its values and be able to enforce them that way? And I think that if you talk to people, they will say, well, there are certain some situations where it is appropriate that perhaps, look, when Father Alberto was discovered to be having an affair with a woman, he had to leave the church.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a big difference between someone who is as highly visible as Father Alberto and perhaps a church janitor whose son gets married and his son puts on Facebook, my family joined me for my wedding.
Well, Greg Allen, it does bring up this interesting line between, you know, a professional organization and having certain guidelines like the Catholic Church does in regards to marriage and the institution of marriage and its beliefs and a person's own ability and freedom of speech.
Right. And, you know, and Archbishop Wensky, of course, is not just the spiritual head of the church here in Miami. He's also basically the CEO of this very large organization. I kind of view it in that realm. He's saying here are our company's guidelines, and you know that's we all work for companies that we could imagine certain guidelines like that. But on the other hand, you have other bishops, other archbishops, church leaders who are saying, you know, let's live and let live.
Yeah.
Let's just sit back. And you know, I the thing that one of the most amazing stories of the last year was the Pope. You know, Pope saying asking about gay people saying, who am I to judge?
Right.
Raised Catholic, that was like one of the most revolutionary things I've heard from the Catholic Church in my 50 years.
Right. I mean, Tuesday night, I covered a rally. It was a renewal of vows in the city of Miami Beach that was hosted by the mayor of Miami Beach, Philip Levine. And it was conducted by three clergy members, one Jewish, one Episcopal, and the other one, you know, from the Unity Church. And so we have three different, you know, religious leaders who were not just in favor of gay marriage, they were actually renewing the vows of couples who had been married elsewhere and whose marriages now suddenly are being recognized in the state of Florida. So to just simply brush this over as something that, well, religious people are against, I think that would be inaccurate also.
Yeah, it's something entirely different. Absolutely. I mean, the face you mentioned and the individuals you mentioned, Steve, not only supporting, actively participating in it. I was at a religious ceremony on Christmas Eve, and there on the back page of the Christmas Eve bulletin was a statement from this religious organization inviting same-sex couples to come get married at this religious organization if the stay was going to be lifted. I mean, it was right there on, you know, among the most holiest of evenings for that particular faith.
Sure. I mean, even among Jews, I mean, if you talk to Orthodox Jews, to Hasidic Jews, I mean, they're going to have a very different position than, you know, more Reform liberal Jews.
Let's go to the phones here real quick. Michael is going to join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup from Miami Shores. Michael, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a gay male. I've been with my partner 19 years now. We're planning on getting married. I'm absolutely elated that this has happened, and I'm just overwhelmed with joy. But I got a concern with our elected officials, and you were talking a little bit about the governor and the attorney general. I called Pam Bondi's, Miss Bondi's office 6 times to try to get a call back. I wonder why she kept trying to appeal this, because as a taxpayer, and we're talking civil ceremony here, and now that it's the law of the land, I think everyone should open up their doors, and I don't think courthouses should be shut down to keep people, just like they could allow straight couples months ago to get married. I find that as a taxpayer, there's a legal concern I have here, that why it's, again, discrimination. It's irritating. I feel it's mean-spirited, and I wanted to get your thoughts on, do you think that some of these elected officials take the stance, namely our attorney general, that, to me, I can't see a legal reason why she defended it for so long and is continuing to try to defend it.
Michael, got the question from the Miami Shores, Thanks. And Mary Ellen Kloss with Miami Herald in Tallahassee, let's put it to you. I mean, the Attorney General Pam Bondi consistently said she has appealed these decisions because it was the will of Florida voters in 2008, 62%, I believe, passed the constitutional amendment that codified into the Florida Constitution that a marriage in Florida is between one man and one woman.
And, you know, she does take an oath that she is going to defend the state constitution. And so that her argument is that it's in the Constitution and it hasn't changed and she's upholding it. So I think the argument can be made that, yes, she was pursuing this to defend the Constitution, but the pursuit of it after losing the first round and second, and then continuing to ask for extension of the stay and so forth, and ultimately, if she decides to, you know, if they continue to take this up to the Supreme Court, and as the U.S. Supreme Court is looking at this, mm-hmm. I mean, that does raise the question of, at what point do you realize you've lost and just accept it? Well, the other side that is kind of interesting is that while we've got the elected leaders fighting to protect this ban, we also had the state government also accepting that gay couples can be covered under state insurance. And so that happened exactly the same day that they're continuing to argue this.
Well, and Mary Ellen, you make up a great point of the business implications of this, and we're going to be exploring some of this on Monday's Sunshine Economy here on LRN. But Steve, you know, the state recognizing same-sex spouses as beneficiaries on Tuesday was something that essentially they had to do because of Judge Hinkle's stay was lifted. That was the law now.
Well, I mean, not just that they had to do it, but it was the Florida Department of Management Services that did it, and that department was a defendant in the suit.
Right.
So very directly, Judge Hinkle ordered that they had no choice but to, you know, not enforce the ban. And I think that this is what it comes down to when you talk about, you know, upholding the state constitution, and that's what Bondi kept saying. But what Judge Hinkle said, and he clarified very succinctly on Thursday, on New Year's Day last week, was that you can go ahead and uphold the Florida Constitution, but if you do it in this case, you will be in violation of the U.S.
Right.
Constitution.
Right. He said in his clarification it wasn't Judge Hinkle asking or saying that county clerks need to hand out same-sex marriage license. It's the U.S. Constitution that is compelling them to do that. We've got a tweet here from Shot Glass Review tweeting at WLRN, the rights and freedoms of a minority are just as valid as the majority, regardless of the majority's opinion on the subject. To that note, Ray has a statement regarding equality here when it comes to same-sex marriage. He joins the conversation from Miami Lakes. Ray, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. It's frustrating to see that the same arguments that were used a few decades ago against biracial marriages by civic and religious leaders are being still used against minorities, in this case, lesbian and gay individuals. So I would like to hear a little bit about your thoughts on that issue.
Sure, Ray. We appreciate that conversation. Steve Rothaus with the Miami Herald, a number of the media headlines on Tuesday morning, Wednesday morning was civil rights. That's been an argument that's been made by same-sex marriage advocates and gay rights advocates. Others in the more traditional civil rights community have bristled a little bit at that comparison and that similarity.
Well, I think that some people might have bristled, and particularly you were talking about conservatives who were involved in the civil rights movement, particularly religious conservatives. And generally, when I say conservatives, I mean religious conservatives, because there were plenty of conservatives who were involved in the right to marry. So, you know, we're talking about religious conservatives who were involved in the civil rights movement who feel discomfort with the thought that, you know, LGBT issues are the same as a civil rights issue.
Greg Allen?
Well, and that's been the heart of these discussions for quite a long time. And, you know, what's happened in this country, that people across the country who've become more familiar with gay issues, because we all have gay people who are in our circles of friends or in our family, as people have personally become familiar with it, they no longer kind of accept the old argument that, oh, someone chooses that lifestyle, right? And that's what we've heard for, you know, for decades,
right,
centuries,
right.
And so now I think I would maintain the polls show that people no longer accept that. And when you start to say that this is not something you choose as a lifestyle, it's something that is part of you, then I think that suggests that it is a civil rights issue.
Marilyn Kloss with the Miami Herald in Tallahassee. What happens with the constitutional amendment that was passed in 2008? Does the legislature now perhaps have to repeal it? Or does it just drop off the Constitution?
If it's ruled unconstitutional, I don't believe it just becomes moot.
Gotcha. It just disappears from the language.
Well, it's there. Yeah. I mean, just as
do we strike through it now on the parchment?
It is just not enforced. Mm. Just as the law against gay people adopting still sits on the books, you know, an appeals court said that the law was unconstitutional, and at some point, then Attorney General McCollum dropped the case.
Yeah.
But the law still is on the books, and it's no longer on the application, are you homosexual?
Well, speaking of law and lawmaking, we are entering that season fast and furious, still to come here on the Florida Roundup. Stick with us. First, it was a promise of 700,000 jobs in 7 years. Now Governor Scott wants Florida to be the global leader in job creation. Politics in the Florida Roundup next. We're back here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Familiar faces came back on the Capitol steps in Tallahassee Tuesday. On the same day, marriage licenses were issued for same-sex couples for the first time in Florida. Governor Rick Scott and Attorney General Pam Bondi were sworn in to their second terms in the Sunshine State. With Republicans firmly in control of the Florida state legislature and the executive branch now, Scott called for bipartisan cooperation and set out the goal to make Florida a global leader in job growth by 2020.
If we accomplish our priorities, invest in education, cut taxes, lower the cost of higher education, and improve workforce development, we will continue to be the number one destination for people looking to escape big government all across the country.
So what do you want from the second Scott administration? Will you be better off in 4 years than you are now? Let us know at 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, or on Twitter using the call sign at WLRN, on Facebook as well, and online at WLRN.org. Greg Allen with NPR continues with us. Mary Ellen Kloss with us as well from Tallahassee and the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times. First, let's tackle the economy here. This was the refrain, Mary Ellen, that we heard during the fall campaign, jobs, jobs, jobs. He repeated his commitment to smaller government and lowering taxes. He laid out a broad economic agenda over the course of the administration, but some of it starts pretty quickly with $1 billion in tax cuts he wants to see over the next 2 years.
Yes. And we'll know more of the specifics of how he wants to do that when he releases his budget proposal in the next month. But right now, how he gets to that $1 billion in taxes is a little unknown, because there really isn't that. There's about $1 billion in new money. And he's also promising to, as part of his jobs promotions, he wants to put more money into education.
Mm-hmm.
He has vowed to keep tuition rates the same, and yet he's also saying that higher education in Florida is going to be the place where job creation is spurred. So I don't know how he's going to get the new money for higher education.
Well, it comes
at
a time.
And he's made some.
Mary Ellen, yes. You know, the state is awash with cash, $1 billion budget surplus, certainly. But yeah, he wants to hold the line on tuition. He wants to increase K-12
education spending, and also talking about some significant investments in ports and for trade, for global trade.
Right, ports, and he's also got a commitment to increasing funding for the roads budget, transportation. So I think that will be pretty much the dilemma for this upcoming legislative session is how do we meet all these needs? And we also have other problems as well that the governor really did not even address in his inaugural speech. The problems with the prisons and the correction system,
yep.
Problems with Medicaid and funding for needy and disabled children. So
yep.
There are big price tag things that have remained unanswered and unaddressed.
And Greg Allen, compare what you heard from Governor Scott, this inaugural speech, versus what we saw, for instance, in his management style and what he did with the economy and spending over the previous 4 years. I mean, this was a speech that, you know, he did talk about Florida being a low tax environment, grabbing folks from New Jersey, people from California moving to Florida, all of that benefiting, obviously, the local and the state economy. But he did lay out an aggressive investment in roads. $25 billion is what he'd like to spend.
But, you know, I heard a great column by Fred Grimm the other day and many other comments from people pointing out all the things that he did not mention. When you talk about what a large state we are and all the challenges
we have. Number three now, population-wise.
I mean, if you just think about what the large news stories were over the past year about the problems with the children and families, the deaths we've had there, the ongoing amazing problems with the prisons, the fact that they replaced the head of the prisons. And then you go on from there to, he did mention the environment. Mm-hmm. A lot of the numbers are all in billions now, we're talking in Florida. So we have a billion surplus. He also wants to spend $1 billion on improving water quality, which is a big priority.
Of which voters did agree with him by passing the amendment that
Amendment
will
One, which
right.
is which is a little different. That's more about, I think, acquiring lands, but that's one more challenge. The fact is, it seems like he wants to be seen mostly as a economic development tourism person whose most main job is to try to attract businesses from out of state, people from out of state. And that's where he's most comfortable. And he wants to talk about creating jobs by bringing people from other states. We're hearing some people saying, why aren't we creating jobs with our workforce here, right, improving right. education? So, you know, there's a lot went unsaid there.
Mary Ellen, there was a lot also somewhat unsaid when he talked about being an attractive place to move to from New York, from California. He didn't necessarily mention New Jersey, another relatively high tax state. He didn't necessarily mention Texas, a state that could right. likely have a tough time creating jobs with oil prices in the $40 or $50 range. Those were two noticeable states he did not necessarily call out and roll out the welcome mat for.
That's because he had the New Jersey governor and the former Texas governor sitting at his side on the dais as he was inaugurated. He had special guests of Chris Christie and Rick Perry. And so he intentionally left out those states.
Let's tackle one slice of healthcare that the governor may decide to tackle or may not. Medicaid expansion. Last year, of course, Governor Scott dropped his opposition to expanding Medicaid, the healthcare plan for low-income residents. Supporters of the expansion are trying to step up pressure on Republicans in Tallahassee, though, to expand the program and take the federal dollars, of course, that are attached to it. Now, advocates gathered in four cities this week hoping to step up even that pressure. Maria May Rodriguez in Miami spoke to us on behalf of her daughter, who has a chronic respiratory condition.
Her medications monthly, they add up to over $6,000. And without those medications, she can't breathe.
Now, Rodriguez and her daughter fall into that so-called coverage gap that exists. They make too much money to qualify for the Medicaid program, which is run by the state, and too little to earn the national federal subsidies to pay for health care on healthcare.gov, aka Obamacare. Now, Mary Ellen, Florida turned down the billions of dollars from the federal government to expand Medicaid. Is this going to be on the agenda in a real way come the legislative session?
You know, I don't think we know for sure how this is going to play out, but this year is a little bit different than previous years. The clock is ticking. We have 1 year left before the reimbursement rate on Medicaid match goes from 100% to 90%. We have the opportunity now where it's possible that small businesses are going to be fined for the first time if they employ people who are like this, the woman you quoted, mm-hmm. who are in this coverage gap. The companies, if they don't provide sufficient health care for them, they are going to have to pay a fine. And the argument would be, if the state were taking that money to treat women like Ms. Rodriguez and her daughter, then we certainly would have less of an obligation for these small businesses to have to pay the fees, and there would be a match. So I think there is some outside the box thinking going on with Medicaid expansion, and I think we might hear some dialogue. I don't predict that it's necessarily going to be resolved this year, but it's possible in the next 2 years we may actually see some kind of modified solution to this.
Greg Allen, we've heard louder dialogue coming from the business community here in the state of Florida over the past 6 months or so, I'd say, in regards to really publicly coming out, large CEOs coming out in favor of federal Medicaid expansion, calling it an economic opportunity.
Right, because under Obamacare, Medicaid expansion was always seen as a key part of it, and it's a key part of the funding mechanism. And if you go ahead and go through with Obamacare and you don't expand Medicaid, then we're finding large institutions like our own Jackson Memorial here in Miami-Dade are finding themselves without a lot of money they would receive. And that's not just here, it's throughout the state. And so you've got this coalition of hospitals, other healthcare providers. Of course, you know the insurance companies are very important players here, and they're all putting pressure on Tallahassee. Up to now, it's not been effective, but I think Mary Ellen's got her close to the ground and understands better than I do what's going on there. What I hear is that the dynamic is not that dissimilar from last year. You've got a governor who at least says he's in favor of
it. Hasn't necessarily been vocal about it, but has dropped the opposition.
Right, he's not going to oppose it.
Right.
And you have a Senate that seems to be leaning that direction. The Senate did pass something last session. The question is what's going to happen in the House. And as Mary Ellen said, there is a lot of kind of smart thinking, outside the box thinking going on around the country around this, so it's possible.
Let's take a look at education then. 4 years ago, of course, when Governor Scott came into office, Florida's economy was reeling, the state budget was a mess because of it, and he cut several hundred million dollars of spending, and a chunk of that came out of education spending. He restored a lot of that over his first 4 years in office when he was running for re-election, of course, and then restored even more than what he had cut in terms of the total amount of spending. But we just learned this week that Florida's public schools ranked 28th in the nation in Education Week's annual analysis of state school systems, and that's below the national average. Here's WLRN's John O'Connor.
Test scores show Florida's Black and Hispanic students perform better than peers in other states. And the gap between the test scores of white students and minority students is smaller in Florida than elsewhere in the country. But Florida earned an F for what the state spends on schools.
An overall C was what Florida received, but an F on state school spending. Mary Ellen, you mentioned in the inaugural speech, Governor Scott talked about increasing education spending. How's that to land on the legislature's ears and laps and pocketbooks and checkbooks?
Well, I think that they are committed to doing what the governor wants. It's one thing to put a bunch of money in, but the governor says, you know, last year proclaimed that we had record education spending. When you drill down into the numbers, it was a record total,
right,
when you look at the entire population. But the per pupil spending still remained below where it had been in the previous term under Charlie Crist.
Right, in 2005, so, 2006, I think, was the high water mark.
Yeah. So I think that the legislature, they do have some additional money to work with this year, and I think they are committed to raising that amount. Now, how far that moves us from an F to a D in the national standards,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, let's talk ethics as well, because this is something the governor did act upon very, very quickly. One of his first acts was to announce a new email policy for his staff. After all, he is the chief administrator here. This governs private email addresses and private mobile phones for the governor's staff. Now, previously, he'd fought efforts to get emails from him and his staff's private email addresses, arguing they weren't subject to state disclosure laws. Change that with this new administration. So how, Mary Ellen, could this term be different in regards to this electronic communication than it was the first time around?
Well, it's very interesting. They bought a lot of time with this argument. They basically bought the entire election season. So I think there are a lot of unanswered questions yet. What happened to all the business that was done, the public record that was done on private emails in the last term? Were they destroyed? denied? We don't know. But going forward, the governor says they're going to be turning over these records. And he and his staff has said repeatedly that they are discouraging people from using private email accounts. I think that we are going to, it's going to be interesting. There's a pending lawsuit right now in Tallahassee that potentially could accuse the governor for intentionally withholding public documents. And if the judge rules against him, we could have the first violation by a governor in history. We'll see. That'll be interesting. But I think the reason the governor changed his position is because he was wrong. They were not turning over records, and they should have.
Mary Ellen Kloss covering the state capitol for the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times with us here on the Florida Roundup. Greg Allen with NPR as well. And we will continue still to come. Haiti struggles to rebuild 5 years after the earthquake as its political future remains very unstable. We're back here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
The community is in total shock. Total shock. People are walking like zombies. Everywhere you go, people are coming to me, embracing me, hugging me, and saying, "Malen, what's happening to us? What's happening to us?" Some people say it's a curse. Others claim, you know, it's no curse. It's just something hard that we are going through.
That was the sound of Notre Dame de Haiti and community organizer Marlene Bastien a day after a massive earthquake hit Haiti. More than 230,000 people were killed, 1.5 million displaced. 1 in 4 schools were affected by that earthquake that happened almost 5 years ago. Thousands more people died in the months after due to cholera. Monsignor Augustin Almi was in Haiti, and the Port-au-Prince Seminary where he was working was where the earthquake hit. He was not hurt, something he calls a miracle today, but people he'd been talking to 10 minutes before died in that disaster. He helped unbury them from the rubble.
I see some seminarian, especially one who fell from the second floor. He had the leg broken. He's screaming outside on the ground. We saw a lot of cops, cadavers on the ground, people dying.
That was 5 years ago this coming Monday. Billions of dollars of aid have been pledged and spent, yet Haiti continues reeling. And on Monday, a political crisis comes to a head. Jackie Charles covers the Caribbean and Haiti for the Miami Herald. Nadej Green is with us from WLRN. And Greg Allen with NPR continues with us as well. Jackie, describe Haiti today compared to 5 years ago.
Well, you know, 5 years ago, there was rubble everywhere. And I arrived in Haiti the day after the quake. And so there was just dead bodies. People were covered with white sheets. Today, when you go to Haiti, it doesn't look like the place was hit by an earthquake, so to speak. I mean, the rubble is gone. I mean, there was enough rubble to fill several football stadiums. Mm-hmm. And you're starting to see some signs of rebuilding. You know, the government has started to put up some buildings. But definitely, the reconstruction has been slow.
And Nadej, what about the relations between South Florida's Haitian community and Haiti? How has that evolved and changed over the past 5 years?
I think 5 years later, people are still a bit frustrated at the lack of progress, the slow progress that's been happening. I know that in the diaspora, in the weeks after the earthquake, people were really hopeful that they would play a substantial role in Haiti's rebuilding, whether that was with construction or whatever that, however that lived. And we're seeing that that wasn't or is not necessarily the case right now.
Yeah, Jackie, what have been the impediments to that relationship? Why hasn't that connection from South Florida to Haiti been stronger than the local Haitian community perhaps would like it to be?
Well, one of the issues, if we just talk about construction, which Nadej mentioned, you know, a lot of the construction contracts have gone to foreign firms, but they have not necessarily been American firms. They're Dominican firms. And in fact, there's a new hospital, the main public hospital. It's a Spanish firm that got that hospital. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's always this tension, right, between Haitians on the island and Haitians who are here. Haitians here would like to go back, but they always want to tell the Haitians on the island how to do things. And so I think you're starting to see a lot of that. But what you also have seen is that the Haitians in South Florida have really risen to the challenge. They took in family members. They took in friends. They continue to support their relatives on the island who definitely need this support.
Carrie Kahn is an NPR international correspondent in Haiti. She joins us on the telephone. Carrie, give us the experience that you've had in just even the matter of a few days as you've been there in preparation for this five-year anniversary, as well as the expiration of the Senate term coming up on Monday.
It's an interesting time to be in Haiti right now. A lot of things are, some people talking at the same time. On Monday is a very important date in Haiti. Hundreds of thousands mourned here. And now Haiti also has to deal with this political turmoil and unrest and uncertainty more than anything that's going on right now. It's unfortunate that the two are clashing on the same day.
We got a little bit of a bad connection to Haiti, but Jackie, talk to us about this confluence of things, this awful anniversary, 5 years of this devastation, more than a quarter of a million people dying in Haiti because of the earthquake, and this real unstable and extremely uncertain political future as the Senate term expires, and really no democratically elected government.
Well, it's being called a prophetic day, the fact that both of these events are happening on the same day. And when I was in Haiti last month and I spoke to people, what they said to me is, first of all, you never will forget what happened on January 12, 2010. It stays with you. You will always remember it. But they would also like that on this January 12th, that you don't have another kind of earthquake, a political earthquake. What we've seen the last couple of days is that President Madeleine and the opposition have been trying to come to some sort of agreement. But as of last night, both sides dug their heels in terms of the prime minister. So the clock is ticking, because at midnight on Monday, what we can very well have is one-man rule with President Martelly ruling by decree, because there is no parliament. I mean, basically, there's no chamber of deputies, and most of the Senate will also have their terms
There's really
expired.
No legislative branch
any
longer.
Yeah, no legislative
longer.
Branch.
Right. Yeah, exactly. The branch that's supposed to be closest to the people of any democratically arranged government when you have three branches of government. Gordon is going to join the program here. Gordon is calling into the Florida Roundup from Davie. Go ahead, Gordon. Welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I speak to Haiti every couple of days. The comment by your journalist there about the inbred feeling of the events of the January 12, 2010, they're still actively implanted in the minds of the general population that were affected by it, and many, many thousands of people live in a silent terror of that happening again. And everybody that I have there, in the sense of friends or associates or just acquaintances, all repeat the same thing.
Yeah.
They simply have this dread of it happening again.
Gordon, go ahead.
They are having little tremors and this and that, and they do run chills up and down the spines of the people there. Now, on the subject of the government, Mr. Lamont was criticized for being too wealthy, and the new prime minister is criticized for being too poor. So what are we doing here? I mean, you know, we've got a staunch opposition to anything that might go ahead. The country can't advance without a working legislature.
Gordon and Davie, we appreciate it. We're going to have Jackie Charles respond to that that comment.
I think that's an oversimplification of the problems. The issue today with the current prime minister, nominated designee, however, you know, he's being called these days, is the fact that the agreement was that the prime minister would come out of a consensus between the president and the opposition. And that has not happened. The president chose his guy, and the opposition is saying, no, that's not going to happen like that. So both sides are digging their heels in. Also, with former Prime Minister Laurent Lamothe, there was a concern that he was campaigning for a presidential campaign while still in office. Now, he denied that he was a presidential candidate, but the perception is that's what it was, and that just continued to fuel impasse.
I know, Jackie, you're going to Haiti this weekend. Carrie Kahn, NPR reporter, is there. What's the feeling on the streets ahead of Monday's Senate expiration, Carrie? Any concerns about protests and tension?
Oh, yes, definitely. There is concern, uncertainty what's going to happen. And we talked to there's a little scene developing right in front of me. I'm trying to get away from it, but a container truck just overturned right in front of me.
My goodness.
And it just brought up a lot of dust. But, there's a lot of concern on the streets. I was talking to merchants in and around the parliament and the big markets out there, and they said, you know, people are tired. Haitians are tired of the constant turmoil. They, especially with the coinciding of the anniversary, they don't want turmoil. But, you know, we've seen protests. They've been small compared to what protests can be in Haiti. There was a couple hundred people that were marching through downtown yesterday afternoon, and they were calling for the resignation of the president. There were some sporadic protests in other parts of the country that were pro the president.
Carrie Khan, NPR national correspondent with us in Haiti. We've got to run here. Certainly be safe this weekend, Jackie, as you go to the island to do the reporting that we will see online and in the newspaper as well. And we will continue our coverage of the political crisis in Haiti here on WLRN. My thanks to Jackie Charles, Nadege Green, thank you, and to Greg Allen as well. Thanks for sticking around. That is the Florida Roundup. And of course, thanks to all the callers, tweeters, and posters. It is produced by Alicia Zuckerman and Steph Farrow. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.